So we come and think of this idea of proclaiming the Lord's death until he comes. One of those phrases that we find in this chapter that I'm sure many of us have read and heard and thought about on many occasions. And we're going to do that again this evening. We're going to think a bit about that, what that phrase says and what it tells us. And however often we've thought about it, my prayer this evening is that as we do so, we will gain a deeper appreciation of Jesus and what he was prepared to do and what he will do for us. If you were with us a month ago when we were thinking about this, we were reflecting on something that Paul had said just a few words earlier, where he reflected on Jesus saying that the cup that he took and shared after supper, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. And he encouraged his followers to drink it to remember him. It's important that we do that, that we do share bread and wine together. But as we do so, we remind ourselves that it's for a particular purpose. It's to remind ourselves of what Jesus was prepared to do for us when he died on the cross. The word used for remembrance occurs just four times in the New Testament. Three of them in the context of the institution of this meal. Twice here in 1 Corinthians and once in Luke's report of that Last Supper. But it's also used in Hebrews 10. Which refers back to the annual sacrifices under the Old Covenant, what they'd done for hundreds of years as being an annual reminder of sins. This meal encourages us to remember what Jesus was willing to do for us, reminds us of our sin, which made his sacrifice necessary. That's what we were thinking about last time, and in that context, we come and think about what it means to proclaim his death. And here, Paul is sort of making a transition, I would suggest, because remembering is often, it's a quiet thing, an individual thing. But here he's speaking about proclamation, a very different concept. It's about telling a story. And it's worth stopping for a moment to think about what Paul actually means. And as I was reading this, I thought about that question. What did Paul mean when he said, whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes? Did he intend it as a silent testimony that the act of eating bread and wine silently proclaims the death of Jesus? Sort of, that as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you are proclaiming the Lord's death. He could have meant that. Or did he mean that as part of the meal, as part of the time together that surrounds this meal, the story of his death is told aloud? Something like, that at the same time as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the events of the Lord's death. What did he mean? And I think there's a strong argument for both of them, which is, you know, quite handy. And I think there's a strong argument for the first one, that as we eat and drink, that act proclaims the death of Jesus. Paul, in this account, seems to be focusing on the act of eating and drinking. There are five references to that in verses 26 to 29. And if we look at the wider context for the whole chapter, Paul is criticizing the Corinthians. He criticizes Corinthians for many, many things. But one of the things he's criticizing them here for is they're actually coming together for a meal. And as part of that, they're taking bread and wine, but they're not really celebrating the Lord's Supper. And he develops that thought further as he thinks about this idea of eating and drinking unworthily, which is our topic for next time when we come back to look at this in July. So he is in the midst of criticizing them, and he could be arguing for a change in behavior so that when they take this bread and when they take this wine and when they share it and when they eat it, they are approaching it properly and they are using it to remind themselves that Jesus was prepared to die for them. I think there's a strong argument that that's what Paul was meaning. But there's also a strong argument that Paul was meaning the other, that he is encouraging them as part of that celebration to speak out the story and remind people that this is what happened. And we've got precedent for this if we go back into the Old Testament. When the people of Egypt were preparing to leave Egypt, let's try that again. When the people of Israel were preparing to leave Egypt, Moses told them that in the future, their children would come to them and say, "Why are you celebrating this Passover meal?" And they were to explain that it was to remind them of what God had done. And we find these words: "In days to come, when your son asks you, 'What does this mean?' say to him, 'With a mighty hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery.'" And this developed into four questions to be asked by the youngest person present at the Passover meal to enable the details of the story to be spoken about and explained. As part of the meal, the story was told. It was proclaimed. There was that desire that the facts of, in this case, the rescue from Egypt were remembered and maintained in their history. I think it's important that we keep in mind the facts and the reality associated with the death of Jesus. So proclaim, in this context, could be actually telling the story. And this word actually occurs 18 times in the New Testament. And in each case, it is about people speaking to other people about something that's important for them to know. It's an act of testimony. It's an act of witness. When we tell each other, when we remind each other of the central facts around which our faith and our hope depend. A time when we tell each other that these things are true. So I think there's a strong argument that that's what Paul meant. The great thing is, we don't need to choose. We can recognise both of these things. That in the act of eating and drinking together, as a shared communal act, we are confirming to each other that Jesus died for us. In a few moments, each of us who choose to do so will take bread, will take wine, we will eat, we will drink. And the symbolism behind that is that we will each be telling the other that Jesus died for us. But we can also choose to take the time and the opportunity to tell the story. And that's what we're going to do in a moment. I've asked two people to come and read from the gospel narratives describing the death of Jesus. One from Luke and one from John, to remind us of that story. Again, an account that we are familiar with, but an account that is good to remind ourselves of. And as that story is told out, I'm going to ask you to allow it to speak into your life as a restatement of what Jesus was prepared to do for you, as a reminder of the historical fact that there was a moment when Jesus, the man who was also the Son of God, died. And allow these words to speak to you as a challenge to how you are going to respond to his death. So let's listen as the story is told. But let's also be prepared to respond. After we've heard these two accounts. There'll be an opportunity for you to comment, to share with us how these words speak to you. Barbie's going to read the account from Luke, and then Sue from John.
Two other men, both criminals, were also led out with him to be executed. When they came to the place called the Skull, they crucified him there, along with the criminals, one on his right, the other on his left. Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." And they divided up his clothes by casting lots. It was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 PM, for the sun stopped shining. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Jesus called out with a loud voice, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." When he had said this, he breathed his last. This one's from John. And carrying his own cross, he went out to the place of the Skull, which in Amharic is called Golgotha. There they crucified him with two others, one on each side and Jesus in the middle. Pilate had a notice prepared and fastened it to the cross. It read, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." Later, knowing that everything had now been finished and so that scripture may be fulfilled, Jesus said, "I am thirsty." A jar of wine vinegar was there, so they soaked a sponge in it, put the sponge on the stalk of the hippus plant and lifted it to Jesus' lips. When he had received the drink, Jesus said, "It is finished." With that, he bowed his head and gave up his spirit.
Thank you, Bev. Thank you, Sue. The thing that particularly struck me when I was listening to those two readings was they both refer to this place of the Skull. And when I was in Jerusalem a few years ago, we'd gone down some streets and we ended up in an open area, and somebody pointed to the place that is referred to as the place of the Skull, and you can see why it's called that. And I know there's debate about whether that's actually the place, but it struck me that I was standing a few hundred yards away from the place where Jesus died. And it brings it home. It's powerful. It's a reality. So thank you for reading those. Anybody else that these words have particularly spoken to them about something this evening? These accounts of the death of Jesus. Yeah. Easy to hear it as another death. Thank you. And that's fascinating because, you know, the people at that time, they'd have seen hundreds of people killed in this way. The soldiers would have got blasé. It was part of the day's work. But as David says, it was so, so much more than that. And that's borne out in some of the narrative, the way Jesus says, "Father, forgive. They don't know what they're doing." The way in which he's in control of the moment of his death. Thank you. Not just another death. Yes. There was that unnatural darkness from 12 till 3. Nature seemed to know that this was not right. And it tried to draw a veil over it. And in those 3 hours, God, in the person of Father, Son, and Spirit, dealt with the problem. Darkness, but darkness that was defeated.
Sometimes when I'm about to go to the dentist, I'm reminded what Jesus thought and went through in the Garden of Gethsemane. I worry about having a filling done.
Yeah.
And this guy knew what was going to happen to him. I don't know if you've ever seen in the graphic illustrations of what crucifixion was like. The Romans, they were experts in pain. They were experts in making sure when somebody died, they died in absolute agony. And I sometimes think, and sometimes it upsets me to feel what Jesus would have gone through and thought, why me? Why me, Father? But he went through it for me.
Yeah.
For me personally, and for all of us here personally, for everybody in the world, even those who come to faith and not come to faith. He knew what he was going to go through, yet he still became a servant and died in my place.
Mm.
And Jesus, for that, we have this bread and wine tonight to say thank you. And every wine time we have this bread and wine, we thank Jesus for what he did for us.
Mm. Yeah, Jesus knew. We see that in the Garden of Gethsemane where he pleads with his Father to say, is there going to be another way? But then he gladly submitted himself to his Father's will, knowing what it would cost, but prepared to do that for us. One more, and we'll move on. Or none more, and we'll move on. Because the story doesn't end there. Even though we eat bread and wine, even as we tell the story of the death of Jesus, Paul wants us to be reminded that this is not how the story ended. If we were simply called to remember that someone died, to reflect on how much he must have loved us, to think about the cost, then we would have memories of that amazing act. But in many ways it would stop there. But as we know, that's not where the story ends. And a few chapters later in this letter to the church at Corinth, Paul reflects on how the story continues. Christ has indeed been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. He did offer himself. He did die. But he is alive again. It is a fact of past history. There was a moment when Jesus died. But there was a moment 3 days later when in glorious power Jesus arose. These are facts of history. It is a reality at this moment in time. Jesus is alive. It was a reality when Paul wrote that. It's a reality today. It will be a reality forever. But Paul also points to a future event. That one day, Jesus will return. And when we think about those things, the death, the life, the future return of Jesus, we are drawn into an amazing story. We recognize that the cross and the person who died upon it is the starting point. It is the foundation for the identity of the church and for each believer in Jesus. As we involve ourselves in that story, as we reflect on its implications, as we explore the depths of what it means, that continues to shape us and transform us. As we experience the presence of the risen Jesus through his indwelling spirit, we gain access to God, we get life, we get hope, we get strength. But this is not the full story. It's a wonderful story, but it's not the full story. That will be revealed when Jesus returns, when the shadow becomes reality, when questions will be answered, when our joy will be complete. Tears, sighing, weeping, pain will be gone. And no longer will we need bread and wine by which to remember Jesus. For we will see him as he is. So as we come in a few moments to share bread and wine together this evening, let's use this opportunity to remind each other of the death of Jesus for us. Let's remember the stories we have heard and our reflections on them. But let's also be aware that one day the need for this meal will be over as we meet Jesus face to face.